Good evening. I knew I needed to be here tonight because the chaplain sent me an email, and it said so in my Outlook on my laptop, which is linked to my Gmail calendar on my tablet, without which I would be lost. My administrative assistant, Kim, also has access to my Outlook, so she can schedule my meetings and general things I need to do. My tablet is my day planner, my telephone book, my to-do list, and it contains a host of memos to take care of. It is my e-reader for books. It's full of articles that I need to read too for work or for general interest. It's my access to the internet. It's my entertainment center for music, movies, and TV shows. It watches my weight and tut-tuts when my carb intake goes too high. It reminds me that I really need to go for a walk. It's a camera. It's my connection via Skype to my family in the UK and Alberta. I can set it up to give me an alarm reminder for important meetings an hour, a day, or a week in advance. It's my maps, my guide to restaurants, hotels, museums, you name it. It's a backup location for students' grades in case my laptop fails or my office burns down. It tells me 2 weeks before people's birthdays that it's time to get them a present or send them a card, or to ask my far more organized wife if she's already taken care of it. She always has. What an astonishing thing my tablet is. I'm reminded of Shakespeare's beautiful phrase from Act 5 of The Tempest, "O brave new world that hath such people in it." Only it's not the people that are amazing, but the shiny tech that we are increasingly dependent upon. Last month, there was a report in the British press that caused a bit of a stir. The Canadian company behind Kobo, you know, the e-reader, released a report on the reading habits of its users. That's right. Kobo has been tracking all its users' reading habits, passively accessing their devices and recording information, such as the length of time the reader was active, how long it took to read particular books, whether they were reread, the percentage of each book completed, and so on. If the devices were GPS capable, the company even knew where people were reading, not merely what and when. The results were interesting. Only 28% of readers who started 12 Years a Slave actually finished it, for example. Less than half made it through Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl. No fewer than 18,000 Amazon readers who downloaded the second volume of The Hunger Games for their Kindles highlighted the same line. Because sometimes things happen to people and they're not equipped to deal with them. What an interesting social experiment. The practice of tracking users' reading habits, common to all e-reader companies, may have come as a surprise to those users. This certainly seems to be the case based on the level of concern expressed in the aftermath of the release of the British report. But it's perfectly legal, especially since those users specifically agreed to it when they clicked on the Accept Terms and Conditions button when they first fired up their shiny new tech. As an editorial in the Wall Street Journal put it, and I quote, "For centuries, reading has largely been a solitary and private act, an intimate exchange between the reader and the words on the page. But the rise of digital books has prompted a profound shift in the way we read, transforming the activity into something measurable and quasi-public. I would suggest that the rise of digital technology has prompted not merely a profound shift in the way we read, but the way in which we relate to one another. In community, in our relationship to political authority, maybe even to our spiritual selves. And the worst thing is, we're only dimly aware that it's happening." Last year, I was in a restaurant with Matt Rios, a former president of the ASU, someone for whom I have a lot of respect. He kept fiddling with his smartphone, almost obsessively checking it for messages. He caught me staring at one point and smiling ruefully said, "I have to. You never know what you might miss." I asked him whether he had to keep such a close watch on things because of something going on at the ASU. He laughed and said, "No, we all do this all the time. We feel like we have to." And that started a really interesting conversation about the pressure that people of his generation were under to stay on top of their online profile, to remain in immediate contact with everyone in their social circles, and to expand those circles as much as possible. In order, And these are his words, which have stuck with me ever since, in order, and I quote, to be real. While it is certainly true that we are in many ways defined by our relationships with others, is it not the case that the hyperconnectedness of digital activities, especially in regards to social media, has not carried things too far? Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, Kick, and a seemingly endless list of other social media environments now make it possible, a requirement even, for people to be fully connected constantly, cultivating current friends and acquaintances and establishing new ones. We try to maintain online personae that present a picture of ourselves that we want the world to see. Yet in our actions, our seemingly banal behavior, our clicking likes, our kicks, our LinkedIn connections, our ad clicks, profile updates, photo shares, books read, we actually construct a different profile, the often unconscious one that, from a corporate perspective, is the more accurate representation of who we are. And of course, the corporations behind the social media sites don't establish capability for connectedness and then offer it for free for nothing. To them, their users are an asset to be monetized for profit. In short, all of the behavior of the digital user is saved on corporate servers, processed, analyzed, parsed, packaged, sold on to other corporations as profiles that can be used to target individuals with advertisements, offers, inducements to buy. An interesting relationship. The social media consumer is given a digital social media playground, and I mean given because most are free, which then becomes the raw material for a corporate structure that is increasingly specialized at stripping away the consumer's sense of self, or projected sense of self, in order to target their deeper desires, often for products they don't even know they need, until they see the ad, that is. The ability to know the hearts of people is a power traditionally ascribed in many religions to the divine and the divine alone. Consider the words of the psalmist that we recited earlier this evening. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from far away. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, O Lord, you know it completely. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is so high that I cannot attain it. 2.5 millennia ago, the psalmist recognized that there is a terrible magnitude to total knowledge of self or others. Indeed, there is in this psalm an explicit recognition that full knowledge of self is impossible for humans, that full knowledge is reserved for God alone. And yet, in the last decade or two, we have begun to surrender our interior selves, the ones that we may not even be fully aware of, to corporate structures that know our sitting down and rising up, that are increasingly acquainted with all our ways. God knows us because God made us. God's relationship to us, if I can put it in crassly contractual terms, is this. Love me and I'll save you from yourself or from those who intend you harm. We are increasingly become known by entities whose contractual relationship with us is, tell us more about yourselves and we'll give you more of what you want. Or we'll sell your digital soul to others who will give you what you want, even before you know you want it. If that doesn't sound like temptation, I don't know what does. When I was a young teenager, there were three seminal moments in my intellectual life, all of which I'm afraid have to do with television. One was a rebroadcast of Jacob Bronowski's The Ascent of Man, which I saw when I was about 12, and which traced humanity's historical development through a history of science. The second, and for those of you who know me, this will be no surprise, the second was Carl Sagan's Cosmos, which opened up my mind to the infinities of creation in ways that, to be honest, no experience with any church up to that point had done. And the third was James Burke's series, The Day the Universe Changed, which showed the way in which truth, as defined by civilizations and cultures, changed as discoveries were made. And in changing the truth, cultures and societies themselves changed too. I can honestly say that the three foremost intellectual influences on me were Brunovsky, Sagan, and Burke. And thanks to the once great public library system in Britain, I was able to devour just about every book they had written up to that point. Although the three series opened my eyes to the incredible capability of mankind to learn about the universe, about ourselves, and the relationship between the two, each also implanted a deep sadness as well. In one episode of Cosmos, for example, Sagan talks about traveling to the stars in spacecraft. There's actually a sequence where one launches and begins a journey to Alpha Centauri, our nearest neighbor. But the lettering on the side of the spaceship is weird, or it seemed weird to a 12-year-old. And Sagan actually drew attention to that. It was Greek, he said, and it was the product of an imagined alternative history, one in which the great repository of classical Greek knowledge, the Library of Alexandria, had not been put to the torch by Christian zealots and Roman bureaucrats. The intact knowledge of the Greeks, speculated Sagan, could have produced scientific and industrial revolutions centuries, maybe even a millennium, before the one in our historical timeline. That in turn could have put us on the road to the stars. Brave new world indeed. But the vast majority of the knowledge of the ancient Greeks was lost in reality through ignorance, fear, or even simple neglect. And so we had the Dark Ages and everything that flowed from that. In The Ascent of Man, Brunovsky, himself a refugee from Nazi tyranny, speaks at Auschwitz of the way in which the Nazis' ability to gather, collate, organize, and with incredible efficiency categorize information on the Jewish population of Europe propelled the Holocaust with demonic force. The ability to know populations using the most advanced bureaucratic information management techniques known at the time allowed the Nazis to round up and crush those populations in a way unparalleled in history. As Brunovsky said, when wading into the pond where the ashes of over a million victims were dumped, his family among them, and scooping up a handful of the mud, as he said, "This is what men do when they aspire to the knowledge of gods." And Burke? Well, the sadness I feel when going back to the day the universe changed was not immediate, but has grown over time. You see, that series is slightly younger than the other two, so I was slightly older when I encountered it. And technology had moved on a bit too. Personal computers were beginning as consumer items back then. Burke recognized, even at this very early stage, what this might mean. In the final episode of the series, Worlds Without End, he forecast that computing would put the sum total of human knowledge into the hands of everyone with access to a computer. It would be a powerful democratizer, allowing immense creative power in the humanities, arts, and sciences. He even predicted, in a fairly basic way, the rise of something like the internet, a connected technology that would allow networked communication and networked access to archives, libraries, knowledge repositories around the world. And we have that. Think about the access that current generations enjoy to what would have been called impossibly exotic knowledge, inaccessible to most of us only a quarter century ago. The entire catalog of the Louvre or the Hermitage in high quality digital form. The ability to peruse, again in total control, digital versions of the British Library's copies of the Gutenberg Bibles or the Magna Carta. It is now possible to linger over the illuminations on the Book of Kells or the Lindisfarne Gospels. Or we can read Darwin's copy of Lyell's Principles of Geology with Darwin's handwritten annotations there in the margins. For that matter, we can review most of Darwin's research notes upon which he based The Origin of Species. We can study the full atlas of the moon generated by the Lunar Surveyor or geolocate the landers on Mars. We can study at 10-meter resolution a map of the red planet created from the photographic data of the Mars Global Surveyor. We can literally go to other worlds through our computers. Even better, we can, as private users and via the internet, gain access to institutional-sized telescopes and task them to particular parts of the sky to study objects that previously would have been the purview only of professional astronomers. Again, what a brave new world. So Burke was right. We have access to knowledge to an extent that was literally impossible only a generation ago. And things are going to change even more radically in the years ahead. Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, projects that by the year 2025, the internet will become accessible via cheap smartphones to 1 billion new users in the developing world. At that point, more than half the global population, which then will stand at slightly more than 8 billion people, will be connected. But connected to what? Merely a marketplace which trades in convenience and profiles, or to what the World Wide Web was intended to be when it was developed by Tim Berners-Lee around 1990? I fear it will be the former. Facebook now has 1.23 billion users, and that's with a B, who access the service at least once per month. More than 700 million of them access it every day. That's 10% of the world's population. The most popular videos on YouTube are those of Korean pop stars and cats wanting cheeseburgers. I'm not saying this is a bad thing. Amusement and humor or simply messing about is absolutely fine, provided that it does not become the focus of activity, which unfortunately the traffic figures pretty much suggest that it has become for the vast majority of internet users. Here we have available to us the most significant shift in the nature and accessibility of knowledge since the invention of the printing press, and possibly of writing itself. And yet we ignore the vast majority of its intellectual power and potential, transfixed as we are by the shinier baubles that are proffered to us by Facebook and the like. We stand in the presence of a new Library of Alexandria, and we'd rather buy the trash of the hawkers crowded round the door. I am reminded of Esau trading his birthright for a mess of pottage. In giving up so much of our inner selves, hardly without a second thought, we are giving up a birthright, one which should be known only to God. And we are shunning the boundless opportunities afforded by a more democratized, easily accessible, and comprehensive body of knowledge than has ever existed in human history. We are in danger, as the cultural critic Neil Postman argued in the mid-1980s, of amusing ourselves to death. Postman developed that argument, by the way, in a comparison of the two great dystopian visions of the 20th century. One was Orwell's 1984, in which populations were oppressed by state control. The other, Postman thought, was much more pernicious. It was a world in which people were addicted to the entertaining distraction of the drug Soma, and thus soporifically unaware of the oppression that had grown piecemeal all around them. That work, which Postman thought contained a more likely prediction of the most dangerous threats to society, was, of course, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Amen.